You're listening to Keystone Cold Cases, a podcast where we reignite cold cases across Pennsylvania.
New York State is alive with stories to tell, from true crime to dark history and the paranormal. New York's Dark Side podcast aims to bring you stories from all around New York State. I'm Amanda Morgan, your host, bringing you tales that you may have never heard before, such as the one of a state-funded school for persons with disabilities that had ties to human experimentation, an urban legend, and an alleged serial killer, or of the mysterious disappearance of a Supreme Court judge that shocked the nation, earning him the title of the most missingest missing man in America, or of how a fake news story regarding the Central Park Zoo sparked terror in New York City and helped influence the elephant and donkey used to depict America's two major political parties today. I have episodes geared to satisfy your curious side and so much more yet to come. New episodes post weekly on Sundays, and you can listen to past episodes now, ad-free, wherever you get your podcasts. I hope you stay curious.
Hey, it's Janelle.
Hey, it's Melissa.
Hey, it's Sean.
Hey, it's Chelsea. And today we're going to cover an older case. But before that, I have some housekeeping that I would like to bring up to everyone who listens. We are doing a special through, I guess, our social medias, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. If you are to leave us a review on any platform that you listen to, we will send you a sticker. If you do this review, you can message it to us and let us know that you sent it, or you can send it to our email. So now we're going to go into a case. It's a case that we have previously done. If you are an old-time listener, you would have already heard this one. It's about Dawn Mazzino, and the family recently reached out, and they wanted us to do some corrections and updates. So that's what we did. We're going to keep the original episode 23, and it was originally had a shorter case tacked onto it. We're going to keep that Jane Doe, and this is going to have a new episode number. So Dawn Mazzino was a 23-year-old Christian woman who is known as being the kindest and loving person everyone in the immediate area of Wayne knew. Dawn had special needs, but was working her way to becoming independent. She was extremely active and overcoming her situation by making regimented schedules and keeping in constant communication with her support system, which included her family and her boyfriend. Her sister told me that she was really connected in the community and was part of multiple social circles. Dawn had attended the Devereaux Day School and graduated. I have heard of this program, and they offer a couple of programs, but she specifically went to the Devereaux Sugartown Road campus program in Malvern, since they lived in Wayne, which is really only about a 20-minute drive. Dawn was provided transportation by the county to attend, and when I talked to her sister, Kath, she said that at the time there were only two locations. This school now is focused on helping students on the autism spectrum, special needs, and behavioral issues. It supports each student in becoming productive, becoming socially appropriate, and helps assimilate into being part of the community. Dawn had disabilities due to lack of oxygen at birth, and Cass said that she was labeled as slow. She also said that some articles listed Dawn with a mentality of a 14-year-old, but she highly disagrees with that. Dawn flourished in this day school and had zero issues. After talking with her sister, this was confirmed. Kath told me that Dawn had started school in the Radnor School District, but it just was not working for her. That's why her family moved her to Devereaux to have a better chance of obtaining an education. She went on taking VOTEC programs while attending Devereaux, then graduated. Right after graduation, she went to work as a dietary aide at Paoli Memorial Hospital. She worked there a couple years until in 1986, and that's when she left to help her sister, who was in a motorcycle accident. She felt she was needed more at home, though when her sister got better, she took a job at Bryn Mawr Hospital within the food services department. It was then she was leaving work at Bryn Mawr Hospital on May 22, 1989, after a shift at work when she went missing. While researching, multiple times were referenced, but the most common time frame was that she left at 3. Her sister said that it is listed that she went missing at the bus stop, but it has yet to be proven. Dawn didn't drive and she relied on public transportation. It is assumed she left work to meet her boyfriend of 4 years where they were to go to Special Olympics practice at the local Berwyn YMCA. Dawn loved the Special Olympics and she was an avid runner and also played soccer. Kath told me she had even won medals during competitions. Now, there was another discrepancy on the day she went missing. I found while researching that she was supposed to meet her boyfriend at the train station versus meeting him directly at the Y. Either way, her mother, Diane, was getting nervous the later it was getting in the evening without hearing from Dawn. When Dawn didn't show up at her expected time, her sister, Kath, decided to see if she had any messages on her answering machine. Dawn's boyfriend had called and left a message asking why Dawn never showed up. I read in one article Diane and her other daughter, Kath, the one that I had been talking to about the updates, they drove to the hospital to see if they could get answers. They talked to the security guards and co-workers. They could only confirm that they had seen Dawn working but didn't know the exact time she had left. So when they couldn't get answers from her place of employment, they called the police to report her missing. Unlike so many other cases we hear about, the police immediately moved into action for the fact that she was special needs, always kept in communication, and followed a regimented schedule. Police and volunteer firefighters searched over three counties, which were Montgomery, Chester, and Delaware County. They brought in track dogs, police crawled through underground pipes, and professional divers volunteered to drag local ponds. There was even a helicopter searching from above for any sign of Dawn. No evidence was found of what could have happened to her. Police then took her journals, datebook, and notes. They also asked the family to compile a list of all of her acquaintances. The family ended up producing 74 names, which the police began to interview. Dawn's boyfriend was one of the first people cleared for her disappearance. Everyone they interviewed said that Dawn was the sweetest person, though a lot of them also said she was too trusting and naive. Her supervisor said that she was the ideal employee. When police were talking with a witness, another employee, the employee told the police they may have seen Dawn after her shift that day at the train station while the witness was sitting at a red light near the station. That's the bus station, I might add. At first, they hadn't thought anything of it because they reported noticing that Dawn looked fairly comfortable. The witness stated she remembered seeing Dawn talking to a man in a red car. And before the witness drove off from this light, they saw Dawn willingly get into the car. This was the first piece of evidence the police received. This witness later picked out Thomas Hawkins Jr. out of a photo lineup, though I couldn't find out how he ended up on the police radar, because the witness didn't say she saw the license plate, just a car. So I just have wondered how it was him. How he got there. So Thomas Hawkins Jr. was a previous co-worker of Dawn's. They had worked together at Paoli. Thomas admitted that he had given her rides home multiple times when they were working together, but adamantly refused he had given her a ride the day she went missing. The family theorizes that Dawn was trying to help Thomas get a job at Bryn Mawr because he was either fired or had quit his last job. He admitted to giving her rides when he would see her at bus stops. But the problem was, it was reported he would give other past employees rides home too. The police searched his car and did find fibers that matched the uniform that Dawn had to wear. The problem with the fibers was they couldn't tell how long they had been there and who they exactly came from. Thomas Hawkins Jr. was bad news, and if the family really knew how dangerous he was, I doubt she would have ever been allowed to be around him. He was a 26-year-old man who at the time was out on parole for being a convicted murderer. In 1980, Thomas murdered a 15-year-old girl in Reading. And I'm going to put a trigger warning out there for you. He raped, strangled, and stabbed her in the neck with a paint scraper. He left Karen Stubbs in a locked room to die alone. And this was in an apartment complex that his parents lived in. He ended up only serving 5 years in prison before being put on parole in 1986. And clearly this is not someone you would want to be spending time with.
So he worked at the hospital, though, at one point? Like, that's how he knew Dawn?
Yes, after... after he committed this crime, when he was on parole, him and Dawn were co-workers.
That's crazy that the hospital would hire a convicted murderer.
It actually is pretty crazy to think that.
Yeah, that doesn't make me feel super great about going to the
hospital.
How
long was he in jail for that murder?
He only did 5 years.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not a good person. So, only 2 weeks after the disappearance of Dawn, Thomas murdered his 14-year-old cousin, Andrea Nicole Thomas. Another trigger warning. She was strangled to death with a telephone and electrical wire. She was found nude except for a bra pulled above her chest. There were puncture wounds in her back and a two-pronged fork that was bent found nearby. She was found by her aunt, who returned to Thomas's parents' house. He covered her body with a blanket and put a pillow over her head. There were so many similarities between both his murders that he was caught for. The trial judge found 18 similarities, to be exact. I did link an article that lists the similarities and also some other statistical information regarding both his victims, if you're interested in learning more. Thomas was sentenced to the death penalty. Monco district attorney at the time, Bruce Castor, continued to suspect Thomas had something to do with Dawn's disappearance. He had offered to take off the death penalty if he would tell them where Dawn's body was. Thomas refused the deal and maintained that he was innocent in Dawn's murder. When I talked to Kath, she said they even offered reward money on top of the plea deal and he would not budge. All the police had against Thomas was circumstantial. The family really just wanted to find the body for closure. At this point, they believe, you know, clearly something has happened to Dawn. People do look at the profiles of both of Thomas's murderers and point out that both girls were in their teens, both were Black, both were of the Seventh Day Adventist religion. With both victims, there was no act of hiding the body. He claimed both victims were flirting with him, and both victims were students at Pine Forge Academy, where Thomas had attended. So those were just some of the similarities in that article. Cass said that the case is still active. She has been pressing the police, and they recently reopened the case. She said that there are 7 other people of interest other than Thomas Hawkins Jr. Cass said some have died, some are in jail for other crimes, and some are on the street. She is worried the police will go right back to Thomas when they start from the beginning, but she wants them to go down other avenues. Apparently, Dawn did a lot of journaling, which created these other potential leads to be researched. Since this is still an active case, she doesn't want to put out too much information. Cass said it is difficult dealing with the authorities because this is obviously urgent for her, but for them, it is kind of on the back burner. This is a really old case, and, you know, these police officers are getting, you know, current crimes. You know, they have so much going on, so it's just really awful for her. She did say in the past the police were open and transparent. I just hope moving forward she has the same experience. I was curious if Radnor Police Department had a cold case team, but she said they did not, so I can only imagine how slow the process can be. Hopefully in the coming months or years, the information found in her journaling will lead to closure for the family. Dawn is listed as a missing person, and I'm assuming it is because there hasn't been a body found. Police though feel that she is no longer alive. The family desperately wants to give Dawn a proper burial. The family says Dawn is still a big part of their lives. They still talk about her and have her pictures up. Diane says, "We march on. Dawn would want it that way." Diane says the police were so communicative and supportive in the beginning. She is quoted as saying, "Not a week has gone by when someone hasn't talked to me. The support in that way is outstanding. It lets me know in my mind that no one is going to forget about it. Probably one of the greatest fears of any mother is that people are going to forget." Dawn had brown curly hair, brown eyes, her ears were pierced, and the last clothes she was seen wearing was a gray skirt, a maroon vest, white shirt, and black bow tie. To provide information, contact the Radnor Township Police Department at 610-688-0050 and ask to talk to Detective Jin Santoloquito or Christopher Gluck. Or you can call the Delaware County Criminal Investigation Division at 610-891-4700 or Montgomery County CID at 610-278-3339. The family has a $5,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of anyone responsible for the disappearance.
Hey, KCC Pod listeners. Have you heard of FanList? Well, you should. FanList lets us at KCC Pod to create a podcast fan page to engage with all of you in a fun and interactive way. With FanList, we can receive audio messages from our fans, whether it be for listener questions, stories, feedback, or whatever you may like. FanList makes these audio messages public, social, and fun. They teach us at KCC Pod to reward our engaged superfans by incorporating your sound bites into our show. FanList's mission is to be the number one audience engagement platform for podcasters. Their goal is to help us engage with all of you, grow their referrals, and monetize our superfans. So go check us out on FanList. Our link is fanlist.com/KCCpod. We can't wait to interact with all of you. Again, that's fanlist.com/KCCpod. Go check us out.
Hey, it's Caitlin.
Hey, it's Janelle.
Hey, it's Shannon.
And hey, it's Chelsea. Today, we're going to be talking about Barry Douglas. He was living at the Pine Creek Village Trailer Park in Gallatin, PA. Mind you, most of us are from southeast part of Pennsylvania. I have never heard of this town before. It's a borough located in Potter County. It is a very tiny borough with an extremely small population of just under 1,000 people. Now, typically boroughs have more residents than the surrounding areas, but not in this case. It hasn't been looking good for Gallatin because the population has been decreasing for years. It is along the northern border of Pennsylvania, just about a half-hour drive to New York. Now, our time frame is July 3rd, 1988. In reports, bystanders who were interviewed said it was a sweltering day. When looking at records, the high of the day was 84 degrees, but the humidity was extremely high. It could be the potential reason why Barry Douglas was out on a stroll in the morning to get a reprieve from the heat in his trailer. He was seen walking along Route 6 towards Wellsboro, and while on his walk, he ran into a handful of acquaintances. His family has said he was extremely friendly, and when he ran into these acquaintances, it was not odd for him to stop and chat them up. Unfortunately, those would be the last interactions he would have. Barry hasn't been seen or heard from since. At the time, Barry was 31 years old. It was known that he was being treated for schizophrenia. His doctors theorized that he could have developed amnesia and walked off. His mother believed that this was the case. I found a quote saying, "Our late mother always believed amnesia was a factor. She said a mother would know if her son was dead, and she never felt that way about Barry." Now, his other family members feel that it was foul play. Now, I'm going to make a mention of this. I've seen his sister's name mentioned different ways. The article that I'm referencing says that her name is Peggy, but her parents' obituary list her as Penny. And obviously, Peggy isn't short for Penny. It's typically short for Marguerite, I think. So I'm going to go with Penny because that's what was in the obituaries, and I feel like those were accurate. But just to note, the what I have listed as a reference will say Peggy. So Penny, Barry's sister, said in an interview with Endeavor News, he was always looking out for his family and friends and was generous to a fault. So we felt that maybe some people from town had taken advantage of him, but there was no proof. It is important to know that approximately a week before his disappearance, his trailer was ransacked. Barry had made a report with the police, but they were never able to find the suspects. Do you think that it's a possibility that it could be related?
I do.
Do we know if anything was missing during that ransacking?
It was briefly mentioned and only in one article, the article that was done with his sister, and it didn't say if anything was taken the week prior.
You said he was being treated for schizophrenia. Could that have been like a symptom or, you know, like an outburst or something where he could have ransacked his trailer himself?
You know, that is a huge possibility. I didn't see anything mentioned about that. It's harder with these older cases because they're really not, there's not a lot of articles on the internet. The only one I found really, minus, you know, newspapers.com where you have the older articles. His sister is the one who brought it up, even on going on like Web Sleuth or Reddit. There's not much information, but that is total possibility.
My question is, he has schizophrenia, so I mean, I see it in all ways, like he walked off because he had schizophrenia, you know, or he was taken because he has schizophrenia. Maybe he was in an episode and he was just kind of in, you know, a delusional reality and, you know, they took advantage of him in that state. I mean, I think schizophrenia is a large term for so many different attributes that could just be a big reason of what may or may not have happened to him.
That's true. And I want to say, back then, they kind of had like a blanket diagnosis for certain things. So I wonder if he actually really did have schizophrenia. It could have been something else, but, you know, as we've progressed, we've gotten more, you know, mental health isn't as stigmatized as it used to be. Maybe it was something else. So it's really hard to know, especially since they didn't really talk about it a lot, and it's probably because it was so stigmatized back then. So when Barry did leave his trailer on the 3rd, he left it unlocked. He left his 1980 Ford Mustang, his car keys for that car, and his cigarettes. His radio was still playing and the fan was on, as if he was gonna come right back. So after a search of his trailer, the police identified the only items actually missing were his wallet and a rifle. Now, thinking about this, leaving his house unlocked and his keys home doesn't really raise a red flag for me because, you know, this is in the 80s where literally everyone was leaving their house unlocked and trusting everyone. From the sounds of it, he was a super trusting individual anyway. So I'm not really, that doesn't strike me as a red flag, though one article I did come across say that instead of it just being unlocked, it was ajar, which is a little bit different to me.
So my question is, the rifle that was missing, could that have been missing when his trailer was supposedly ransacked the week prior?
It could have been, absolutely. But no one made a mention of that. And one of the things that I had in my head, like, if he had taken it with him, wouldn't you think that the passerbyers would have noticed something like that? Rifles are huge.
Mm-hmm. Could it have been a possibility that he was having a mental health crisis and possibly that's why his rifle was gone? Like, he took it himself?
When I think about those things, like, you mean like a suicide because of struggling with it? Wouldn't you think there would be a body somewhere? Because, I mean, you can shoot yourself, but you can't hide it.
Yeah, a lot of people, like, go somewhere where people can't find them. Stuff like that, though, so I figure could be a
point to that is his location was kind of a mountainous area. It wasn't an easy terrain, so it could be a total possibility.
To go on the location, I was just looking back. It says it was very close to New York. So if only like Pennsylvania State Police or whoever was searching this, if he was so close to New York or wherever, he could have been far gone away from Pennsylvania before anyone really was really looking to where he could have been or what might have happened.
Absolutely.
Do we know if he was, like, a hunter or anything like that?
I did not see anything about that.
So if he lives in a mountainous area, maybe he could have, you know, went hunting and then something happened to him while he's out, like get hurt and get stuck somewhere.
It could have been. I know that he grew up in the area. His parents, you know, raised their kids in the area. And so it's definitely something that is like a possibility that they grew up with hunting. But you do make a good point. I also, Janelle, I couldn't find out exactly how long it took for them to, like, one, who made the report that he was missing and when did that happen. I did not, couldn't find, like, a pinpoint of that. So I wonder how long he went before, you know. In efforts to locate Barry, state police used dogs and helicopters to search for him in the mountainous terrain. The search had volunteers and trained searchers helping. I will say I was shocked that the search was called off only after 2 days. Barry's family and friends did continue to look in the hopes of finding him. As we always hear, small towns are rumor mills, and this really caused his family turmoil. Penny said that my mother used to receive phone calls at all hours of the night from people claiming to be Barry or saying they knew where Barry was. Those calls tormented her, but she would never change her phone number because if she did, Barry wouldn't know how to get a hold of her.
Do we have any clear understanding as to why 2 days? I only ask because, one, he's diagnosed with schizophrenia or some sort of mental health issue. So why would you call off a search for someone that obviously can't take care of themselves properly in 2 days?
Yeah, and it was noted that his medication was left at home too, so that's also, like, surprising.
Back then, I don't think mental health was taken as seriously as it is today, so that could be a big reason why.
Another thing that I think is, like, I live in a borough, and we don't even have a full-time cop on duty at all. And it's just, like, people just picking up extra shifts from other, you know, departments. And he lived in a borough. It's pretty tiny. They might not have had the resources.
Mm-hmm. They have budgets. A lot of police, they have budgets of what they can spend on search and rescue. And a lot of time, 2 days worth of searching would probably cost thousands of dollars. So that is a possibility that it was costing them too much money to keep searching.
And also, he's an adult, and there was no telltale sign that there was an absolute, like, I guess, emergency, if you will.
Mm. He could have walked away on his own accord.
Exactly. On July 5th, 1991, Irene, his mother, did an interview with Star Gazette, which was right around the third year anniversary of Barry's disappearance. She told the paper that she had hoped the TV show Unsolved Mysteries was her answer. She had written numerous letters and was told to collect as much information as possible. Apparently, the show directors were considering running Barry's story, but from what I can tell, this never actually materialized. I tried searching it a ton of different ways in Google with, like, zero luck. And in the same interview, Mansfield State Trooper Robert Buchanan said investigators have received no leads in the case since the disappearance. As long as he has not been found, the investigation is still open.
Is it just Pennsylvania State Police looking for him or having the case open? Is it open to any other state?
It said that solely PA state troopers were looking at it, and when they have, like, the contact, if you have any information, it still is just for a Pennsylvania State Police barracks.
I'm just wondering, you know, back in those days, he was so close to New York, if he didn't travel to, like, Canada, you know?
Well, you have to remember, back then, police offices weren't really cooperating together. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the thing back then. But I do know, I'm gonna be mentioning it sooner or later, they do have available DNA and dentals in cases, like, there is, you know, a John Doe that shows up and they're trying to figure out who it is wherever John Doe could be. So they could match him.
Okay.
It really kills me knowing that his mother passed away without literally any closure. And same with his dad, but it seems like the mom did most of the, you know, interviews in the beginning, even compared to his sisters and other family. Irene Rawson, because she did remarry, passed away at the end of 2002. In her obituary, it states she is survived by Barry, so she really never gave up the hope of finding him. And neither has the rest of the family. In the Endeavor news article, Penny said, "I promised my mother before she died in 2002 that I would do everything I could to find out what happened to Barry. We're hoping someone will come forward so we can have some peace and closure. Time passes so quickly that we're afraid if nothing comes to light soon, we'll never know what happened to him. Nobody deserves to be forgotten like that." And I will say, his case getting solved, like, soonish, wouldn't be the oldest case that's solved in Pennsylvania. And sometimes people have deathbed confessions. I don't think that it's, like, 100% not solvable, but I definitely think someone's going to need to say something for any resolution or a body be found.
Yeah. It almost sounds like he could have been robbed or somebody... If his trailer was ransacked, somebody could have taken the gun as well, like, if it wasn't him.
Yeah, it's so hard to know. That's the hardest part about these cases.
Yeah, there's so many different things that could have happened in this case, really. Like, so many different avenues.
Exactly. The Endeavor News article was published June 24th, 2017. They ran the article a month after Crime Stoppers issued a news release hoping to gain some new information. A spokesman from Crime Stoppers said, "We haven't received any new tips, but we're hoping that by putting this investigation back in the public eye, we'll attract some attention and eventually gather some new information to help police get to the bottom of this." In July 2022, Barry Douglas's case was the missing person of the week on the Charlie Project's blog page. Again, most pages have the exact same info. There's just hope putting the case in the public will drum up some clues. The only information I can find out about Barry's life before the disappearance is through his parents' obituaries. His father passed away first on January 18, 1981, before Barry disappeared. Edmund Keith Douglas was a veteran of the Korean War and was an active participant in his local American Legion Post 291 in the VFW. After the war, he was a self-employed auto mechanic. He died at a young age of 54 suddenly. Then Irene Rawson worked at Gallatin Production and several area restaurants and businesses, according to her obituary. She was a member of the Gallatin Free Methodist Church and loved her flower garden, which, same, I love that about her. The pair had three children, which were Barry, Linda, and Penny. Barry Douglas would be 67 years old today. His birthday is September 9th, 1956. Barry is 5 feet 6 inches, 200 pounds, has red hair, is a white male, and has blue eyes. His one picture that we will post with color is just breathtaking. A redhead with blue eyes, it's kind of rare, and he's very, very handsome. He was last seen wearing a bright yellow t-shirt with Thousand Island River Rat printed in black letters on the front, blue jeans, white socks, and sneakers. His sneakers were white. According to the Doe Network, like I mentioned before, they have available DNA and dentals. If you have any information, you can call Pennsylvania Crime Stoppers toll-free at 1-800-4-PA-TIPS. All callers remain anonymous and could be eligible for a cash reward, or you can reach out to the Pennsylvania State Police Mansfield Barracks at 570-662-2151.
Hopefully now, in this day and age, now we have social media. Back then, there wasn't really Facebook and all social media, really. Now, we can get the word out a lot more through social media, so it might be, hopefully somebody will see it and come forward.
That is the hope. That's all we have for this episode of Keystone Cold Cases podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and please consider leaving us a review wherever you get your podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast, the host, and the cases we cover, or if you want to suggest a case, please visit us at kccpod.com or send us an email at keystonecoldcases@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at Keystone Cold Cases and on Instagram or TikTok at KCC Pod. Please remember never to reach out to family or friends of the victims, only to law enforcement if you have any tips. This episode was researched and hosted by me, Chelsea. Find all of our sources, social information, and contact information at KCC Pod. Theme music by Darren Makins and production assistance from Shannon Bipple. Join us again next week for another case to sleuth out.